Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips, with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.
Wait, wait, wait. Before we start, just want to make sure we're clear here. While this podcast talks about sobriety, mental health, and addiction, it is not meant to replace professional medical advice. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety.
I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Sonia.
And we're ex-sisters-in-law, brought together in marriage and bonded through our sobriety journey.
Join us as we talk sobriety, addiction, and everything in between. You're in for quite a ride. And our Substack is buzzing with amazing content, from creative mocktail recipes to insightful courses and reflective exercises. There is something for everyone. Don't miss out. It's a great way to add some extra joy and depth to your journey. Check it out. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety. Today, we're joined by Chris Jensen, a board-certified performance and mindset coach with a master's degree in counseling psychology. She's also the author of Grace Yourself, How to Show Up for the Sober Life You Want, which debuted at number 26 on the USA Today bestselling books list. And Chris spent years secretly struggling with alcohol addiction while balancing her role as a mother and a professional. And today, nearly two decades into her sobriety, she is sharing her journey and offering a path to freedom for others questioning their relationship with alcohol. And her work empowers people to overcome shame, release perfectionism, and step into a sober, fulfilling life. Welcome, Chris.
So glad to be here, Sonia. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited you're here. Can you share a little bit about your personal journey with alcohol and what led you to sobriety?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I got sober in 2007. I was 37 years old then. And for me, my story, and this is all in the book as well, my story was that nobody in my family identified as alcoholic or had been to recovery. I was very confused. I'd heard of AA. I'd heard the word recovery, but I thought that was for, you know, people not like me. Maybe chugging from a paper bag under a bridge type of thing. I just didn't know. And also, my parents didn't grow up as drinkers. I was from a non-drinking household. And which, looking back, is really nice. You know, everyone in the family lives a really long time. My aunts and grandmas, like they, you know, 100 or more. And now I'm thinking there's a correlation there. It just wasn't, they just didn't drink. And I also was from a loving household, had loving parents that were always very supportive, nice neighborhood. And I say that to say I can't pinpoint one thing that caused it other than I just was trying to exist in this world once I got, you know, out of my parents' home and went to college. And well, even it started in high school. And was around people who drank socially, I never could moderate my alcohol from the get-go. I mean, I didn't do really outwardly embarrassing things. It wasn't obvious to other people I had a problem. It was a big problem for me. And I somehow was pulling it off on the outside. I was not pulling it off on the inside. I knew it was a problem right away. But I also didn't, I thought, because of that, what I just explained, I thought the problem was me. I never considered the problem was alcohol. I thought the problem was that I needed more discipline and willpower. And somehow these other people that were moderating alcohol and drinking socially somehow had figured this out. And I just was too weak and I needed to try harder to do that. So because nowadays, I love nowadays that we can say, hey, We have mocktails. A lot of people can't moderate alcohol. We have, it's okay to be alcohol free. There's no stigma. We didn't have that back then. Mm. I was confused. You either go to AA or recovery or rehab, admit you have a problem with it, or you are able to carry on like a normie, like a regular drinker. Or someone that can moderate alcohol. So I hit my pain threshold and Googled where to go. And I did go to an AA meeting. I went to a 12-step meeting. That's what came up on Google. I was scared to death. It was an all-women's meeting. I went the morning after drinking too much wine while doing back-to-school paperwork one night. Again, nobody, you know, my kind of blackouts and passing out were after the kids went to bed at home in private. Still, nobody had seen me. I did ask a pastor, a therapist, a doctor, a friend about it because I knew I had a problem. And they all said, oh, honey, you don't have a problem. That's, you know, rehab, recovery, that's not for you. But I knew I did. And so I went to this meeting. And a woman in the group said, it's not your fault. You have a condition. It's like an allergy and you never have to have another drink again. Stay with us. We're going to show you how to do this. And so I did. And I stayed there and I didn't have another. That's what started my recovery journey. And it was a life changer because I was so confused, I had so much shame and guilt on my shoulders because I thought this was a me problem, because I thought I was weak and not disciplined enough and that somehow other people were better than me because they could moderate alcohol. So when she said that, all that shame and guilt flew off my shoulders. I realized it wasn't my fault and recovery began. And you know, and I will say, if anyone has even a slightly similar situation, the thing that was so funny about me thinking I didn't have discipline, and I was like killing it as a mom, a wife, a like PTA president. I was facilitating Bible study, for God's sake. You know, I was like, I was an athlete. I was doing all these other things in life. And that played into why people were like, well, you don't have a problem with alcohol. But I did. I did have one. And so that was a fantastic life. I got to raise my kids in sobriety. They've still never seen me drunk. I have three kids. They're all in their 20s now. My husband and I have been married almost 30 years. We've just had a wonderful life. And but part of my story that's in the book and what inspired the book is that in 2020, we moved, like a lot of people during the pandemic, to a new state where I'd never lived before. I tried to get plugged into my meetings. I didn't find any right away. And we were also brand new empty nesters. The last kid had left the nest. And I, like a lot of, you know, like I thought all the things people in recovery warn you about. Well, gosh, maybe I drank over all these other things. Maybe I'm not alcoholic. Maybe, you know, it's been almost 14 years now that I've been sober. So maybe I don't have a problem. So I invited alcohol back in, not on a low note, on a high note. Like I was a life coach. I was already had a coaching business. I had all these coaching tools under my belt and a head full of recovery. So that's all in the book, how that happened, because I know that seems like, how could you let that happen? I did. And it is far easier to stay sober than get sober. It was very difficult to get sober a second time. I did it. I'm back. I wrote a book about it and did find my recovery group. And in that time, because now it's different. So when I was looking to get sober again, now we had all these other groups, online resources. You don't have to go to AA. It doesn't have to be 12-step, which I think is wonderful. Recovery in itself is a win. I think we all have different churches, therapists, because we're all different people. So we need different recovery groups too. However, for me, trying to get sober again in these new groups or by reading new books or by trying things like not labeling myself an alcoholic, when actually labeling myself that was what saved my life, because that label helped me see, oh, that's the reason. Like, it was never stigmatic or a bad label for me. I get it that it is for other people, but so to get sober a second time, these other groups just weren't working for me. So I ended back in my 12-step group, which was how I was able to get sober a second time.
I identify as an alcoholic, even though I'm not in AA. I've been to meetings, and it's a big part of my identity, right? And so how were you able to make that switch from I'm an alcoholic to, you know, I think I'm okay to have a drink?
Mm-hmm. It was confusing. It was like an identity crisis from the get-go. And the problem is, and hopefully people who are considering the field trip I went on hear this, the problem is if you knew at one time you had a problem with alcohol, whether you identify as an alcoholic or not, and that it wasn't moving your life in the direction you wanted to go, yes, you may have evolved and changed and have better tools now and are more mature now, but I promise you, alcohol has not changed. It is still just as cunning and baffling as it always was, right? And it does, as we age, the effects of alcohol on us, they age, they get worse even when we're not drinking. That was my experience. And people had told me that, you know, I don't know if you've heard the analogy, you know, I've heard it said a lot that people like me and you were like, we've been pickled, and a pickle cannot go back to being a cucumber. And so I'm here to tell you that's true. You can't. I thought I could be a cucumber again, but I guess I'm, you know, we're also, a lot of us stubborn. A lot of us are high achievers. A lot of us don't quit. You know, we just keep trying. And so all of that kicked in too. When I drank again, the shame and guilt kicked in because now I'd stained my perfect streak. All the perfectionism came back that I'd worked to erase because now I have a new day one. So I had to let go of that and check my pride on that. But, you know, also what kicked in is my high achieverness, my performance pressure. Like, well, I'll just need to try harder. I just need to, of course, I'm not good at it right now. I just started again and I haven't had a drink. I need more coaching. I need to practice more. And every time I worked to get better at it, of course I got worse at it. So it was just, I'm so happy to be free of it again. It's just such a mind trap. Such a mind trap. And I only could do that with community.
And so you have your AA community, but at home the first time around, nobody really saw you drinking or saw you as having a problem. Did your husband or kids start to notice it as an issue?
The second time, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
My husband did. And my husband did the first time. He knew about it the first time. So he always supported it. And at the same time, he's very optimistic. And we both have the same mindset. Like, oh, maybe it wasn't a problem. And he's not. He's a normal drinker. He's not in recovery. He understands recovery. He knows it through me. It's different, though, if you're not the person that's felt these things. So my kids, the second time a few more people did notice, like the last night, my last drink, you know, I was at a party with neighbors and they definitely noticed, and they're very loving, and what's great is they knew I was sober. Like, they knew I was a person who didn't drink and that I was fried it again. So, you know, thank goodness the cleanup was small. The cleanup was just a conversation the next day. Hey, go, you know, I drank again and they were very loving and understanding.
So the cleanup was easier, but the process of getting sober was harder the second time?
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
In what
very
way?
Hard. Because I didn't go right back to that same community that I got sober in the first time. And I think for me, that made a difference. And I'm definitely not saying that that's the right place to get sober. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that's what worked for me. Yeah. And I didn't go back there. I was too embarrassed to go back and say I was on day one. So I tried all these other resources. I read all the Quitlet books. I tried different apps and things to be part of online sober communities. And I can see, I can attest to the fact that those programs are working for people.
Yeah.
Especially people that it's their first time. It just didn't work for me because that's not how I got sober the first time. So I kind of have this head full of, you know, yes, I know those work. And I'm so grateful that we have more than one option for people, you know?
When you say it didn't work, you say you kept drinking while
I kept drinking. Like I'd go a week and then I get, there was this idea that there was a lot of, and this is probably just the groups that I was in or the books I was reading, but there was a lot of like, let's not label ourselves alcoholics.
Yes.
Let's you're not alcoholic. Alcohol is this toxic poison for everybody. And there was a real like negativity around AA,
yes,
which was confusing. I see it now. I didn't see it then, but that was confusing because AA saved my life. And there's millions of people like me that it saved their life and we're able to remain sober because we're part of AA. And again, that doesn't mean it's right for everybody or the only thing. It's not the only path, but neither are these other things. And I didn't like how these other groups bash AA. I just didn't like it. And so that was confusing. And this idea that I glommed onto, because I'm like, oh my gosh, I can, you know, there's this mindful drinking groups. And I was like, great, I can be a mindful drinker. That didn't work. Right? What's a mindful drinker? Like, if you're like me, you cannot have a sip of alcohol because the obsession kicks in. So I was trying to be one of these people that could moderate and be a mindful drinker. And then I also tried, like there was this idea that you can drink if you want to. It's just once you understand the effects of alcohol, you won't want to. And so I tried that. But the problem was one day I did want to. So now what do I do? I wasn't able to say, well, the reason I didn't have a why for not drinking anymore. My why now is because I'm alcoholic. It's like my son is deathly allergic to peanuts. His why he can't eat a peanut is it will kill him. So that's my why. But that why got erased. And I started thinking, well, if I want to, I could probably, you know, it was very confusing for me.
Yeah.
I was confused and I needed to go through that process. I'm not confused anymore. I have a solid why. And I've developed some great coaching tools to help people with their why. It doesn't have to be the same as mine. And maybe these other groups and different things will work for people. And I have clients who are alcohol free for health reasons.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic. And I don't think they need a recovery group. You know, so I don't think everybody needs a community. I think if people are like me and they've been pickled, it's in a drinking world, it's impossible for me to remain sober, at least emotionally sober, without a recovery community.
Yeah. I mean, it brings up something really interesting. I've been to every meeting under the sun. I've been to AA meetings. I've been to all the like non-AA meetings. I've been to online, in person. And you're right. The non-AA based meetings, it comes from a rational, you need to rationalize alcohol is a toxin. Alcohol isn't serving you. But there's something about my sobriety, and I talk about this a lot, that comes from a place of fear, right? It really does. And I sometimes feel guilty about it. And people say, you know, if you're coming from a place of fear, then it's not authentic. But I will say there are days where, on bad days, 70% of my motivation comes from a place of fear. Like on a day where I'm on vacation and I think, what's the worst that could happen if I had a drink? And it's like, this is the worst that could happen. I will tell you, but the worst, I will scare myself into, I will play that tape forward into the ground. And so where do you kind of stand on that sort of like fear, maybe even, I find a lot of coaches, we talk about the difference between deprivation and abundance, right? Are you depriving yourself of alcohol? Are you coming from a place of fear? What do you think?
Well, I have a section in the book called Fear Versus Vigilance. And I think that in recovery, we need to be vigilant. And even if it's not alcohol, if someone's trying to eat better or give up a habit that they know may kill them or is very bad for them or just not leading them in the direction they want to go, we need to be vigilant. We need to be, you know, sober-minded and alert and vigilant. I think that's different than fear that may be anticipating we will fail. I think vigilance is knowing what could happen and being aware of it so you can avoid it. I think fear is if we're anticipating what's going to go wrong, it may go wrong. As a coach, I remind people constantly, we get what we focus on. So if you're focused on what you don't want, you're going to get that. Like if you're driving down the road focused on a telephone pole and that's all you're focused on, you'll drive right into the pole. So even though you don't want to. So we want to focus on what we want, not what we don't want. And when we're in a place of fear, we're focusing on all the things that could go wrong. So they might. And I just think that's different than vigilance.
I'm going to rename my condition vigilance.
Yeah.
And not.
Yes.
I mean, because that is it, right? I am not.
Yes.
I'm not tiptoeing around worried I'm going to drink again. It's just when it comes up, I, I am vigilant. I try to make good choices. You're right.
Well, you were playing it on fast forward, which is such a good thing to do. And I just would call that vigilance. I don't think that's fear. I think it's smart and logical.
There is one thing that I've seen come up in my own life. So I'm curious about this. So my brother got sober with AA and he kind of stopped going after 5, 6, 7 years, and then at 10 years had a relapse. And he was, like you said, just too ashamed to go back to AA. Do you think that is something to do with AA and the ideas that you have about relapse? Or do you think that's really a personal thing and that people need to get over it? You have a relapse, just go back to AA.
I definitely don't think it's a 12-step thing. I don't think the 12 steps talk about pride in reverse. And when we have pride in reverse, or the big book talks about it, I should have said. So what that is when we have so much maybe embarrassment for going back, shame that we stained our record, self-loathing, negative self-worth. In essence, that is another way of playing God or our creator and saying, you know, I know what I'm worth better than my creator or the universe or my higher power. And so when we do that, it is another form of pride and it keeps us stuck and it keeps us relapsing and it keeps us from moving forward to getting recovery again. And if we can get over that ego-centered part of ourselves and that pride, we can go back. And I don't think it's AA that's causing that. I think it's our human nature. And if anything, if you're in a healthy AA group that's teaching the 12 steps, they're going to teach you what I just said. So it's the opposite.
Do you remember when I talked about True Diagnostics' True Age Test? Well, I took it myself. And the results blew my mind. I found out I was actually 39 years old biologically, while I'm 46 chronologically. But what was really eye-opening were the areas where I was on the borderline, like my blood sugar and cholesterol, and True Diagnostic gave natural recommendations to lower both of those.
It matters because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 50%. But the good news is, almost 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and your environment. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging. And that was also eye-opening. I discovered that my brain is biologically younger, but my lungs need improvement. So I started doing some type of cardio daily. And honestly, I feel so much better knowing how my systems are aging so I can do something about it. The test itself was so easy and convenient. I did it from home. There was no doctor, no needle, just a quick, painless finger prick. So you send off that tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. It's fast and hassle-free. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to True Diagnostic and use my code CIS2025 to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use CIS2025 at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
So we move a lot. I've been to AA all over the United States, and I've visited AA in other countries. And I it's hard to find a group that would put shame on you or make you feel bad for relapsing. That's just not what they do. And I think if for some strange reason you found a group that did that, just go somewhere else. Because I haven't encountered it in 18 years of going to meetings.
I'm curious what the reason was. And I see it and I get it, like, of going to the kind of alternative groups and thinking, I can do this without AA. Or is it because they make it, because you don't have to label yourself? Is it because it makes it kind of seem like a softer process where you have more options? In contrast, my sobriety is hard. It is a hard sobriety. And I do appreciate those groups, but yeah, they don't necessarily work for me either. So what was it, do you think, that said, let me try these other ones before I go back to AA?
I think I was trying everything, which is my nature, an achiever. Let's try everything that may work. I had a lot of pride, and my own ego was keeping me from going back to AA. Yeah. It wasn't because of the group. It was because I was ashamed to start over on day one. So I thought, as long as I'm out, yes. And as long as I'm out, let's see if something else might work better. I mean, those things weren't around the first time I got sober. So why not try everything? And my faith happens to be Christian, and which doesn't matter. I'm just telling you that to say I was at church And the pastor one time said something about, there's this faith-based recovery group that's quite popular, and it's not just alcohol, it's all kinds of things. And the pastor had said something like, I go to this group because they don't label people as alcoholic.
Yeah.
And because I heard that, and this is while I was out trying to get sober again, and because I heard that, my brain thought, oh, I'll try that. Maybe my problem was I was labeling myself.
Yeah.
And so I went to that group, and it really, not because of the group, just because of where I was at, but it led to my last drunk when it was very bad. Because someone in the group talked to me about mindful drinking and how they, I put the story in the book because I think it's important. They talked to me about how they prayed for it to be lifted from them, the alcohol misuse. That was it. And so I thought, oh, I'll just do that. And, you know, I almost died that night because I had a sip because I was trying to use it without misusing it. But I can't do that because I'm alcoholic and the obsession kicked in. And that was my last drunk. I mean, it was really bad. And so it's not because of that person. It's just because I was trying different things and that didn't work. And because I think that why does need to be, I can't drink because I am alcoholic. And if someone doesn't like the word alcoholic, I want people to label themselves with what's empowering.
Yeah.
So if alcoholics, I mean, maybe that's really disempowering because maybe you had a alcoholic family member. So don't use the word then if it's disempowering. But if you're someone that really cannot moderate alcohol and you need to abstain, then I would say stay away from ideas or people that are wanting to coach you on moderation, because that could kill you.
It does seem like that label scares people. But in regular company, if someone says, oh, you don't drink, I say, oh, I had a problem with alcohol when I was younger. I don't always use the word alcoholic because I do think it has a stigma, and I hope we're breaking it a little bit. But I think when I just meet people, I will say, oh, well, I had a problem with alcohol. But
yes,
I think there's something so permanent that people feel about labeling themselves. Mm-hmm. And so they'll do anything to avoid doing that.
Yes, yes. And it is different in different situations. We have to have sensory acuity, know the audience, right? And in different seasons. I'm on a podcast about recovery, so I'm telling you and your listeners I identify as alcoholic. I don't say I'm alcoholic in front of people that wouldn't understand that.
Yeah.
Because it's confusing, and I don't want to confuse people. I don't want to cause people to stumble. Mm-hmm. I really only say it on things like this, in my book, or in a meeting, I say I'm an alcoholic. So in my mind is what I'm saying is I identify as that. I do not go out telling people I'm alcoholic because they wouldn't understand. I don't want to cause confusion.
So you go through this, this process, you get sober, it's harder the second time, you end up back in a great AA group, and you think, I need to write a book about what just happened.
Yeah.
What inspired you to start writing Grace Yourself?
Well, it's my second book. The first book's a coaching book. It's a simple, has my favorite coaching tools in it. I wrote it for my clients as like a tool, a guide to use between sessions. And one of the chapters is on patterns and habits. And so I made that chapter into a whole book. And really, I wrote this book. I shared my own experience in order to present these tools to say, mine was alcohol. What's keeping you stuck? What's your stronghold? We can use these tools for anything. But I'm going to use my story with alcohol to help present this so you can understand how to apply it to your own life. You know, it's funny because I wrote the book. When you write like no one's going to read it first. Then you edit it. And so I wrote and I thought, why? I don't really want to share this story with other people. Mm-hmm. And they can't, Then we edited it, and it is a book now. So now I am sharing the story with other people. It's vulnerable and embarrassing, but I feel like the message is very good. I think we grow by sharing stories, so we all know we're not alone, and someone needs to go first. Some of us need to share, and the older I get, the less I care about what people think of me. And it's just interesting because a lot of my family and close friends didn't know, like most of them had no idea the stories that are in this book because it just wasn't really their business. I was sober. They knew I didn't drink, but that is for my friends in recovery, right? That's where I go to share the story. And I think that's what's so great about these groups is we don't have to go out and write books and be loud and proud and announce ourselves. We can be anonymous. I happen to write a book, but that doesn't mean everybody needs to. We can be anonymous. And if you go to a group, whatever group that is, and have community, no one's telling you what to do or giving advice. We're just sharing stories. That's the only way we're growing. We're just sharing stories. And every now and then you see yourself in someone else's story and are inspired by it. And so that's what I did in the book. I'm just sharing stories and also giving some coaching tools.
Yeah. What does grace yourself mean?
To me, it means, so because I shared I'm a person of faith, I think it's God's grace and it's unmerited favor. And in the book, I talk a lot about how as a young woman, I had a very controlling personality. I had to control everything, like brace yourself. I was always trying to control every situation. I was a perfectionist. I was a rigid thinker. So I write a lot about that in the book and how that couples with addiction. But that control, when you want to be the one in control of your worth and who you say you are, you cannot accept grace because grace is God's unmerited favor. You get it no matter what. And if I didn't understand grace before recovery because I thought, I'll tell you what I'm worth. You know, I didn't do anything to earn this. Therefore, I'm worth nothing. And that's, we don't get to decide that. We don't get to decide how valuable we are or how worthy we are. We just get to accept it. And when I think I'm in control of that, that goes back to what I mentioned before, that pride in reverse where I'm playing God and I'm deciding that I'm playing God. So that's what grace yourself is just accepting it no matter what. And if that's difficult for people to do, we can ease into it and act as if and believe it until that it catches up and we really believe it. And sometimes we just have to work at that belief and condition it at first.
I think that like brace yourself personality is pretty frequent in people who struggle with substance use. And so you said something about perfectionism. I know in the book you talk about ways to release it. What is one way that we can start to release perfectionism?
One way is, and I love having a pen and paper, write down all the rules you have for getting a certain goal you want, right? Like say you have a goal of having a wonderful podcast. Well, write down, what is a wonderful podcast? How will I know when I've had a wonderful podcast? Define it. So have a crystal clear goal, but then ask yourself, what rules do I have for myself for having this podcast? Are some of the rules that everybody's going to like it. It's going to get 5-star ratings and have, you know, if X, Y, and Z. If those are the rules, I have clients adjust those rules because those are rules that are outside of our control. They are up to other people and we can't control other people and what they think of us and our podcasts or our books. And so one tool I really love is adjusting the rule to things that are within your control when you set your goals. Otherwise, you've set standards that are impossible to reach, making it very easy to fail, very easy to feel bad about ourselves, and almost impossible to achieve.
Yeah.
And that's perfectionism. If it's not perfect, it's trash. And that's just not realistic. That's different than being a high achiever or high growth, where we just keep tweaking the strategy. We do what it takes to get where we want to go, but we don't ditch the outcome. We don't crumple it up and throw it in the trash.
Yeah. Another thing you talk about is the stillness of sobriety. And another thing I was not before I got sober was still at all. But can you explain what that is and why it's such a struggle?
When we get sober, at least for me and a lot of friends like me, there's this thing where at first we think we're bored. Oh, sobriety's boring.
Yeah.
And it's not boring. It's just that's called serenity. And you haven't been still yet. You're not used to feeling your feelings. You're not used to stillness. You're not used to extra time in your brain when you're not either bashing yourself or looking for the next hit or whatever it is, judging yourself and others, all that stuff. When you start getting sober and emotionally sober, there's just room in your brain for other things. And a lot of people call that boredom. And I don't think it's boredom. It's stillness. It's serenity.
Yeah.
It's peace.
Yeah.
We have to just get used to it because that's different for us.
It is. I think one of the least peaceful times is when you are stuck in a cycle. And so what are some first steps for someone listening that feels trapped in that addictive cycle?
No, it is scary to break any pattern. And that may really be fear. We talked about fear and vigilance. Mm-hmm. That's a healthy, normal fear. It's okay. It's okay to be afraid. Mm-hmm. The fear does not mean you're not supposed to do it, though. So that feeling of whatever it is, fear, anxiousness, resilience to break a pattern is a sign that you're in the right place. You're moving out of your comfort zone to grow and stretch. You're right where you need to be. There's other people that have been where you're at and keep going. We don't want to pause, plateau, or move backward. We want to push through the comfort zone toward to the other side.
And
break the pattern.
And so I'm sure that was one of the lessons, but you've worked with so many like top performers in their field. And so what lessons from peak performance coaching apply to sobriety?
Yeah, that's one of them. And then choose your heart, right? Doing that, breaking that pattern will be hard.
Yep.
And then, but let's, again, write it down on paper. What is the cost of not breaking that pattern? And get leverage on yourself. Which will be more hard, right? So we don't want to look for a sign that something's easy as the sign that that's what we want to move toward. If there's something you want, let's say the want here in this situation is to break a pattern that's not serving us, well, know that be honest with yourself. It will be hard. If you're giving up alcohol or a drug or a food or something that your body and brain has become conditioned to, that will be uncomfortable to break the pattern. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't do it or that it's wrong. It's just you're choosing your heart. And so getting that leverage is really important. And I think for peak performance, I work a lot with people on that focus that I talked about. So focus on what you want. Get a real vision, and this exercise is in the book too. Get a real vision of that person you want to become, what you want to move toward. Picture that person. Picture that person, the you in the future, free of whatever it is you want to be free of. What do they look like? What are they wearing? What does it smell like? What does it sound like? Get a real visualization and make that your focus. Even if you don't want to or really aren't feeling it quite yet, it might not, it's not supposed to be natural, because you've got to be intentional about it and condition it.
Mm-hmm. I love the choose your heart. That's the second time I've heard it in the last year. So I was wondering too, so how do you suggest people handle, we can call them whatever we want, setbacks, relapses, and really not let it define their journey? And so how do you wish you had handled it after your first drink after 14 years?
I wish I had less stubbornness and pride about going back to my group. And I would say you're not alone. People in recovery, there are far more people in recovery that have relapsed than haven't. And I'm not suggesting that we go out and relapse to be like everybody else, because it really does suck. If we're talking about choosing our heart, it was way harder to relapse than it would have been to just, keep trying to stay sober till I found somebody or a group to help me with it. So, yeah, just know you're not alone. Have some humility. Get over yourself.
Yeah.
And this idea that people care that we're on day one again is just not true, right? Yeah. And if you're feeling that, I mean, it's hard to imagine, but if you really are feeling that, go somewhere else and don't just quickly go, oh, well, see, I was right. I suck. Yeah. No, just keep looking for the people that want to welcome you back with open arms, because there's thousands, millions of people out there who've struggled the same way you have.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things when I talk to people that they struggle with AA is the day one, right? It's like, do I have to go back to day one after I had a drink once? And so I know it is an important part of AA, but how do you see it? I look at relapses as like amazing opportunities to learn. I actually think it's scarier that in 8 years I haven't had one, because I haven't had an opportunity to like learn from the trigger or from the thought process that led up to it. But yeah, how do you feel about, is it necessary for so, because there's so much like, I have to go back to day one. How do you feel about it? You think it's important to do that? Do you think?
No, I think it's different for everybody. And in the book, I walk people through asking the questions, what is it for you? Because, and if, you know, if you have a mentor or sponsor or someone telling you how you have to do it, maybe find somebody else, or because it changes in the seat. Like I was very, for me, this is just for me, I had to stop counting days when I came back, because it was really tripping me up. It would just felt like another judgment, like we're just another standard. And it wasn't. And so I had to let go of the day count. Mm-hmm. I know my day, but I waited till I had like a good 6 months till I started celebrating again. And now, and I do, I love celebrating. So I love getting my chip and celebrating. I love all that, but I kind of waited till that worked for me again. So just be aware, like if it's working for you, if you want to go in and say, I'm on day one and that's great, and that's moving you forward, by all means do it. If it's not, you don't have to do it. You don't need to keep a day counter. There's no, this is your life. There's no rules. These are suggestions. Even AA and 12 step, they're suggestions. They're not God. It's suggestions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, it's funny. I don't celebrate boyfriends until 6 months either. It's really important to me that they make it to the 6 month mark. Yeah, yeah. I'm like, everybody calm down.
What? Well, lots of, everybody calm down. Simmer down.
Yeah.
No, and lots of things. You know, I've had 3 babies. I don't go telling people I'm pregnant till a certain amount of weeks, right? So you can do that with sobriety.
Yeah, you just want to make sure it takes. I just make sure. So, Chris, what is next for you, and how can people connect with you and your work?
They can connect with me on my website, chrisjansencoaching.com. And my services are there, all of the places to get the books, both my books. My first book's called Living All In, How to Show Up for the Life You Want. Second book's Grace Yourself, How to Show Up for the Sober Life You Want. And What's next is I'm starting a third book. I just really love to write. Mm-hmm. So just still coaching and writing. It's not coming out anytime soon. I'm just starting, but it's a long process writing a book and then editing. But that, yeah, I just want to serve people through this mess. I want to be a good steward of the message of this latest book. You know, now that I did do the embarrassing thing and write it.
Yeah.
And now it's out there for public consumption. I'll just be a good steward of that message. And if some people are helped or they find camaraderie with a shared story, then that's a good use of the book.
Yeah, I think you were an awesome steward. And thank you so much for being here. And thank you all for listening to Sisters in Sorority. And we will see you next week.
Thanks, Sonia.
This was Sisters in Sobriety.
Thank you for listening and being with us today.
If you want to learn more about sobriety and meet your community, find us at sistersinsobriety.substack.com.
Are you a sister in sobriety? Then reach out on social media. We'd love to hear from you.
If you're feeling generous, leave us 5 stars and a review and follow us wherever you listen.
You'll never miss an episode. Until next time.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
You want the best for your child. K-12 can help them gain the skills they need to reach their full potential while giving you the support you need to get them there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Their state-certified teachers make online learning interactive and engaging, allowing your child to learn at their pace from the safety of home. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.